so before you leave. Next case is Justin Riley against the Commonwealth. Mr. O'Brien, Mr. Stoller. Mr. O'Brien, how are you doing today?
Well, Your Honor.
Can I reserve 5 minutes, Your Honor?
That'll be fine. Before you start, I want to talk about a procedural issue. The final sentencing order was November 3rd, 2016, right?
Yes, sir.
And there was a motion to reopen filed November 16th. And the court, on the next day, the court ordered the case to be reopened. And on December 20th, trial court allowed the amended plea.
Yes, sir.
December 20th was certainly more than 21 days.
Was.
After the final judgment. Was there an order that modified, stayed, or vacated the sentencing order of November 3rd?
Judge Frank, this was going to be the first issue that I brought up as it was. I'm glad we're on the same page. I believe the order from November 17th does that, Your Honor, and I think in order to with my argument, the motion to reopen that was filed the day before says that by agreement with the Commonwealth attorney, defendant would like to file a conditional plea and preserve his right to appeal the court's ruling. The intention of the parties at that point was to reopen the case so that a condition.
I don't know that it's relevant. What's relevant is whether or not that order specifically vacated, modified, or vacated that sentencing order. Isn't that what the law says? You don't imply that. It has to specifically do one of those three things.
Well, the order then says to reopen the order from the 17th says to reopen this matter to allow the defendant to amend his guilty plea to a conditional plea of guilty. And I think that it's also important to note not just that language, but that it was seen and agreed by the Commonwealth attorney. That shows that
well, they agreed to reopen it, but again, Judge Frank's question is, where in the record does it indicate that the otherwise final order, previous final order, was ever stayed or suspended or vacated?
Seemed to be like a motion to reconsider that wasn't heard within the 21 days.
Well, I think you need to look at it with the motion, that the motion creates the platform from which the order, which the court speaks through.
But doesn't the court speak through its orders? But if there's not an order either vacating or suspending or superseding the prior order, I think Judge Frank and Judge Humphrey's question is, then what are we left with? We're left with the what?
We're left with my argument that when you look at it with the motion and the language of the motion and the intention of the parties to reopen so that the conditional plea can be added, because I think a conditional plea has to be...
Judge Lilly's order, and it says simply, in pertinent part, it is a judge ordered and decreed that the case be reopened and placed back on the docket on December 8th, 2016. So I guess the question is, does simply ordering it be reopened, what legal effect is that? To me, at least, it means it's just being placed back on the docket for further action by the court. Being taken out of the closed category and put in the open category and stuck back on the docket. But unless somebody, I'm kind of sympathetic to your position, but the Supreme Court precedent that we're bound by is pretty draconian when it comes to this. If you don't suspend, vacate, or set it aside, the previous, and 21 days goes by, the circuit court has lost jurisdiction. If the circuit court has lost jurisdiction, we have no jurisdiction to decide this appeal. I think
it's
the limit we have right now.
I would agree that that's the language that the Supreme Court has. You have the motion to reopen, you have the order.
I guess you have to convince us that reopening equals staying or vacating or whatever, I don't know of any authority on that point, but maybe you found some.
I have not found any authority that I can present to the court. The only thing I can argue is the intent of the parties was to reopen it, and I think that's seen by the scene and agreed by the Commonwealth as they've signed this order, that the intention was to reopen the procedure.
There's a case that says there was a telephone conference, and the trial court said, I will allow you to... withdraw your plea or whatever it was, and it wasn't reduced to writing, and the appellate court said that doesn't vacate or stay, even though that was the party's intention. Well, I mean, you sort of want to argue the merits of it, but you understand our dilemma.
I understand the dilemma.
If we can figure a way around it, fine, but if we can't figure a way around it, we're not going to get to your merits. It's that simple.
I understand that, Your Honor, and I don't have anything. I don't have any authority that I can present to the court. I can't say that as an officer of the court. And there's no other language other than the language that the court's pointed out.
I don't want to argue the merits.
That I pointed out. But I think that the reopening stays. And that's the position I need to take at this point. I'm not willing to concede that.
Well, you shouldn't. I mean, that may be the law, but I don't want to
concede. The issue, Your Honor, the issue on the merits, I think, is very simple in this case, Your Honor. It's whether or not there was a reasonable suspicion for the stop. The facts are uncontroverted. The officer was sitting in a position observing a four-way stop sign. There was a car in front of the defendant's car. Both cars came to a complete stop. There was an unobstructed view of the north-south travel on the night in question.
But the statute requires you to stop at the whatever the line is, or the crosswalk. Doesn't that what the code require?
846.2.821 says the driver of a vehicle approaching an intersection on a highway controlled by a stop sign shall immediately before entering such intersection stop at a clearly marked stop line. The case, the Umberger case that I cite in my... It is a civil case, but it I believe, is applicable in this situation as it states the law in Virginia. And the language in that, the language in the code as it was in 1952 is very similar in that it includes the immediately before entering language that's also found in the case that Judge Frank, in the code that Judge Frank is citing. It says immediately is not a word of very precise signification. It does not necessarily import the exclusion of all interval of time or space. Its meaning is determined by the context in which it is used and the purpose for which the statutes were enacted. The purpose of the pertinent provisions of the statute is to require the operator to bring his motor vehicle to stop, to a timely stop, before entering the travel portion of the highway. It then goes on...
Statutory construction is it says what it says.
The court then addresses that later in its decision, Your Honor. Where it's
I was going to ask why it matters, because let's assume for the purpose of my question that your client, with the benefit of 2020 hindsight, we conclude it was close enough for government work, and the fact that he stopped behind the car in front of him before he actually got up to the line, as Judge Frank described it, you know, didn't constitute necessarily a violation of the law. That doesn't end the analysis, does it? Because if the officer is mistaken about that, reasonably mistaken, and this is the case of Hine versus North Carolina, the U.S. Supreme Court said that can still constitute reasonable suspicion. A mistake of law without any kind of bad faith on the part of the officer doesn't necessarily negate the concept of reasonable suspicion.
I don't think it's a mistake of law. I think it's a mistake in the officer's interpretation of the law.
Well, that's exactly what Hine says.
Well,
Hines says the officer was in North Carolina was mistaken in its conclusion that three stoplights, brake lights, were required on a vehicle as opposed to only two, because of some confusion in the way their statute was written.
Well, in that issue, I think it's the difference is the I don't think there's any factual argument in this case. He definitely came to a stop. He stopped at the stop sign. He stopped at the stop bar. The question
is... Change the facts. Suppose he was the fifth car in line. Would your argument be the same?
According to Umberger, I think that analysis would be the same, Your Honor. The reasoning and the rationale in the Umberger case is that the statute doesn't require the operator of a motor vehicle to bring his vehicle to a stop within a stated number of feet. The sign is a notice of danger and it requires you to stop so that you can see whether or not there is any impending danger coming in either other direction.
That's the point, it seems to me. If the statute is ambiguous to the point of being confusing, that's the point that Hine makes, that we don't penalize the officer. We don't expect them to be lawyers and parse, you know, do statutory construction exercises by the side of the road when they're making traffic stops. And if it's, you know, if the officer hasn't acted in bad faith and it's the totality of the circumstances render his actions reasonable given the ambiguities in the law, that doesn't negate his right to stop and investigate what's going on.
Well, I don't think there's any ambiguity in it. I think that the issue is, did he stop at the stop sign?
Well, I mean, the ambiguity is where, though. I mean, you just conceded to Judge Frank's question that, you know, one car back or five cars back, or I guess 10 cars back, doesn't make any difference. As long as you stop at some point before you reach the stop sign, you're good to go as far as the statute is concerned. That's your interpretation of it.
I think there has to be some level of common sense that comes in this situation. And it says when it's clearly marked, and I think if you're 10 cars back, 12 cars back, 8 cars back, you can't see that it's clearly marked. I think that when you come to a clearly marked stop sign, if you stop and you determine that there's no impending danger coming, which is an uncontroverted fact as to what was going on in this situation, that you are free to go through. That, I believe, is the interpretation that the Umberger
Court... Mr. Ryan, you started your rebuttal. Can you keep going?
Thank you.
May it please the Court. Craig Stoller on behalf of the Commonwealth. Just to quickly touch on the merit, we always talked about the fact that the statute... The case he cited from 1952 talks about stopping immediately before the intersection is somewhat vague. The statute that we have now is fairly specific in what it means by that. It says, immediately before entering such intersection, stop at a clearly marked stop line, or in the absence of a stop line, stop before entering the crosswalk, or the near side of the intersection, or in the absence of a marked crosswalk, stop at the point nearest the intersection roadway where the driver has a view. There's a number of different things specifically laid out in the statute where the driver is supposed to stop. Clearly, the car in front of Mr. Riley stopped at the stop sign. Mr. Riley did not. The officer had reasonable suspicion, if not probable cause, to stop him based on that traffic infraction that he witnessed. And as the court indicated, even if I'm wrong in that interpretation, I don't believe this interpretation is so unreasonable that police officer action would be held to be unreasonable in stopping him because of the wording of this statute. I think the statute is clear. I think the officer acted appropriately and that he had, in fact, at least reasonable suspicion when he stopped the car.
Statute specifically says where you stop.
It does. It lays out three or four different options. Stop at the stop sign if there's no stop at the stop line. If there's no stop line, stop at the stop sign. If there's no crosswalk, stop at the closest place to the intersection where the driver can see clearly in both directions. Here, there's at least a stop sign and a stop bar. He did not stop at either one of those. Therefore, he's in violation of the statute as it's worded. I think that the language is clear. And regarding the 21-day rule, to be honest, I am not familiar with the motion to reopen other than in the context of a trial where after the Commonwealth rests, it may wish to reopen the case to present evidence it neglected to do earlier. Other than that context, I'm not familiar with a motion to reopen used in the way it's being used in this instance. So I can't say that it inherently...
Mr. Stout, I've got to tell you from my own experience, Virginia Beach has an entirely different vocabulary than you must compared to about such things.
But I'll say, I am not aware that this order would comply with the requirements that it be modified, vacate, or suspend the previous order. In my own practice, I know that I filed motions to reconsider in my previous life as a defense attorney, and the 21 days ruled, even though everybody's agreement that they was going to hear it, because the order was not entered to also modify, vacate, or suspend the previous order. It is draconian in its application at times, but it is, as they say, the first rule. 21 days after that, you're done.
It's not a question of filing date, it's the date where the court acts on the motion.
Correct. The order would have to be entered modifying, vacating, or suspending the order prior to the running of the 21 days. It's not an intention to do so, it's not everybody agrees to do so, it's that order must be entered within 21 days of the final order in order for the court to retain jurisdiction of the case. And that, again, I think is also clear law.
And so, the case law uses the word explicitly.
It does. The court seems to be saying that one of those three words, if not all three of them, must be used in the order in order to have the circuit court retain jurisdiction after 21 days of an otherwise final order. So I think the trial court lost jurisdiction, therefore this court has no jurisdiction. But if this court does find it has jurisdiction based on the motion to reopen, I think the officer acted reasonably and the court should affirm the trial court's verdict. I'd be happy to answer any questions the court may have. Thank you, Your Honor.
I think at this point, if the court doesn't have, if the panel doesn't have any other questions, I'll stand by my original.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.